Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the new year and the Supertone Show. Get ready for love.
Most of all, nothing much ever really happens. God rides high up in the ordinary sky. Yeah. Till we find ourselves at our most distracted, the miracle that was promised creeps quietly by. From the high window palace, sending grief and joy down in some part of our doses. We search high and low without mercy or malice. Well, the gate to the kingdom, a sweet shut and closes. Praising him for, praising to God, what you're praising him for.
Praising a little bit more,
yeah,
praising a little bit more,
yeah, praising to God, what you're praising him for.
Praising to God, what you're praising him for.
Praising a little bit more,
yeah, praising a little bit more.
And get ready for. Search the seven seas and I've under the carpet. I browse through the brochures that govern the skies. Then I was just hanging around, doing nothing. I looked up to see his face burned in the retina of your eyes.
Yeah.
Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds and Get Ready for Love from their 13th studio album, Abattoir Blues, The Lyre of Orpheus, released on the 20th of September in 2004 on Mute Records.
We like Mute Records. We love Nick Cave. He's great. When I first got that record, I remember putting it on and that's the first track.
Yeah.
Right, and you put it on, you go, holy moly. It goes, get ready for, and then it just goes bang. Wow. What a sound. And I love him because, you know, we've played quite a bit of Nick Cave on the show, haven't we? And he goes from really, you know, sensitive, beautifully written songs to something really rock and roll. I mean, it's balls out that, isn't it? It's like gone mad. He's gone crazy with the thing.
He's like somebody dancing when he doesn't think anyone's watching.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
That's right. And the band, I mean, was it formed originally by Nick Cave and...
Mick Harvey.
Yeah, Mick Harvey and Blixer Bergeld, which is not his real name, but...
Oh, right. He's from West Berlin.
Yeah.
Blixer Bergeld or whatever.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Great name.
Cool guy. That's right. Yeah.
So they were formed in Melbourne, of all places, in 1983, the actual origins of the band. Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because, of course, formerly, previously, that was in The Wedding Present, which is one of our mates, Ant Alonso's favourite bands of all time.
Of course.
Never got The Wedding Present, though, but we certainly get, I certainly get this guy. And Blixer, he'd left just before this album, hadn't he?
Yeah, it's the first album that he hadn't played on.
Right, okay.
What was quite interesting with this album, though, it's a double album, so you've got a total of 17 songs, and so you've got 9 on Abattoir Blues, and then the other album is The Lyre of Orpheus. It was all recorded in a couple of weeks, and it went to number 1 in Norway, and it's interesting, number 2 in Austria and Denmark, and number 5 in Australia. And it's just... They're kind of two sides of a coin, aren't they, almost? Mm. They're very, very different. Do you know, I really like the end of that track, though. It's almost like he skidded around the corner, stopped and ran into a plate glass door or something, you know? It just...
and the Hammonds sort of just hanging on. You know, it's like...
It's a bit comedic, actually. Ready for love.
Sounds a bit like the end of Walking Out the Door by because you know at the end where the Hammond goes, it sounds like it's being strangled.
Yeah.
Oh, it's really cool. But the interesting thing, I just want to go back to Blixer for a second because he actually, he was in Ein Stuart Sender Neubauten, of course. And that was like one of the destruction of new buildings. I think that's the literal translation from German. And they were really instrumental in that whole... industrial, you know, sound that was coming out of Berlin and Hansa Studios. And,
of course.
And people used to turn up to Hansa just to see him because, and Ein Stuart Sender Neubauten, of course, were famous because they dug up the stage in the Royal Festival Hall in London and were banned for life because they used a lot of, you know, angle grinders and all that to make the music. And they used a jackhammer on the stage and smashed it to pieces, which didn't really really endear him to the thing. But his real name is Christian Emmerich anyway, Blixer. So,
really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's... I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, there you are.
Get you. All right, then. All right, what about this then? Produced by, actually recorded at Studio Ferber in Paris, France.
Now, we know a lot about Studio Ferber, but go on.
Yeah, so we've got Vanessa Paradis, Manu Chao, Vampire Weekend, Jane Birkin, all those kind of people. Lots of French people recording there in Paris.
Yeah.
And produced by a guy called Nick Launay. Now, it's quite interesting with this guy because I was looking at him, you know, because I know you know a lot of producers and I kind of think, well, who's this dude then? So he started working in 1980 at Virgin Records Townhouse Studios and he was an assistant engineer on the Jam's album Sound Effects, XTC's Black Sea. And he worked assisting people like John Leckie, Tony Visconti, Steve Lillywhite and Hugh Padgham.
So they were like the second wave of great British producers.
Exactly.
Came through,
So I kind of like that story. And then when he was in 1981, he was the most junior member, assistant engineer, working on the new Public Image Limited recording session for a single called Home Is Where the Heart Is. Mm. Now, of course, we know about John's reputation.
John Lydon. Johnny Rotten.
Johnny Rotten. because of course he had a reputation of like throwing up, walking over the console, just basically being quite abusive to people he didn't like. So what happened in a nutshell was that the guy, the engineer they'd brought in to actually do this session, this guy, Nick, knew more as a trainee, as a junior, about the desk, the SSL desk, than this engineer did. So he was asking for triplets and doing all different sort of musical things. Can you do that? So, of course, Nick had to keep going up to the front because he's supposed to sit there quite at the back with the tape. And he was helping this guy work the desk.
Okay.
So in a nutshell, when this guy went out to the toilet for a bathroom break, John locked the door on him and told him to bugger off.
John Lydon, you can't beat him, can you?
Oh,
Yes, Roundabout from their first studio album, Fragile, released on the 26th November 1971 on Atlantic Records and recorded at AdVision Studios.
Yes.
And what do you think about that?
Well, I'm a bit blown away by it, actually. I've never really listened to them properly, you know, just close your eyes and just go into the soundscape. It's quite incredible. I had no idea because I don't really know Yes.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the first time you've actually heard it.
I know.
Because, of course, you know, we got the album kicking around downstairs, but I put this on because we haven't had Yes on the show and they were so important. And I'm not, I've got to say, I'm not a huge, huge fan. I mean, the there are tracks and albums that are absolutely outstanding, but this track has got a lot of connection with me personally. You don't know this.
No.
Firstly, the old drummer from the band, Whitefire, my first rock and roll band, was in a band previous to that called Fragile because it was, they loved Yes. Yeah, so that was the first thing.
Okay.
Secondly, the record cover, of course, was designed by Roger Dean, who we know from the island. We've met him a few times now.
Yeah.
He comes to the Isle of Man quite a lot. Big friend of our mate Dave Mosley. So we've met him, so we know about that. And, of course, the other thing, Rick Wakeman, who spent a lot of time on the Isle of Man as well.
Indeed.
And we know about that, of course. And
I've been to his Christmas party in May.
What, you've been to a Christmas party?
Yeah, Rick, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I had a friend who knew him, so I rocked up and we went to hang out and have Christmas dinner in May and he was playing with his son.
And it sneaky, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, there we are. You see, we've been married 6 years and we still have things to learn about each other. Wow.
It was good fun, actually. He's a lovely guy.
Well, yeah. Well, he's also a great keyboard player and he joined this band just before the album, didn't he?
Yeah. Phenomenal, actually. I was reading about that going, really?
Mm.
I mean, I think what it's because I was trying to find out more about them, you know, because there's this thing where, because I've missed them and I wasn't around at the time, it's like new music to me. It's like it's released contemporarily today because it's still fresh.
It still sounds great.
So I know, I make no apology for that. I'm actually really loving doing this show just because there's all this wealth of music. It's not staying in the past. It's actually finding it for the first time.
Mm.
And I love the fact that you can share stories. We come at it from different perspectives in a way. So what I didn't realise, okay, so Chris Squire and John Anderson formed the band in 1968. And they realised when they met.
John Anderson's from Accrington.
Accrington Stanley, where they have Holland's Pies.
Well, that's right, and I know them very, very well. So, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, there we are. Now, you see, you didn't know that. Anyway, carry on. Accrington, yeah. Go on, because that's very close to where I was born and used to live. So.
Right, okay. So when they started chatting, they realised they both loved the vocal harmonies of Simon and Garfunkel, and they started writing together. So it's just really, they found a musical connection, really. So they started playing at they played a gig at the Speakeasy Club in London because they were filling in for Sly and the Family Stone, who couldn't make it. And then...
As you do.
This is the weirdest thing, right? And this is how it reads. And then they were chosen to open for Cream's farewell concert at the Royal Albert Hall on the 26th of November. So you go... I'm reading this going, really? Really? And then that led to a residency at London's Marquee Club and their first radio appearance on John Peel's Top Gear radio show.
Yep.
Then they opened for Janis Joplin at the Royal Albert Hall in April 1969 and then they got signed to Atlantic Records.
Well...
Isn't it interesting? And so they went on tour in 1971. They went to the US, opened for Jethro Tull. Then they were back later that year, sharing the same billing as 10 Years After. And then when they started working on this album, Tony Kaye quit, their keyboard player, because he preferred the Hammond and they wanted Moog.
Yeah.
So he left and in came with his sweeping cape, Rick Wakeman.
I've seen, yes. Virtually more times than I've seen any other band. I've seen them about six times. And each time, they're absolutely great. And I used to have a joke with my mate in a guy called Paul Braddock, who used to work for, he still is, Wigwam Acoustics.
Yeah.
And he used to work in a music shop in Manchester. And I used to go in there a lot, you know. And, of course, Steve Howe always, he's a witterer. he's... And I always used to call him a whittering guitar player. And he plays like Fender Twin Reverbs. It's like a very, you know, it's a very unique sound. He's got a lot of acoustic stuff. But I always used to call him a whittering. We used to have tremendous arguments about a whitterer, about this whittering guitar player. But on there, Rick Wakeman as well, he sounds very much like, now, Keith Emerson. Because that solo in the middle of there, that is, it's almost, I wouldn't say it's a rip-off, because I know that Rick Wakeman's a great musician in his own right, fantastic, probably one of the best keyboard players, apart from Rick, that's ever been, really.
Yeah.
And Keith, should say. And, yeah, so, I mean, but it sounds very like it. And it was produced by Eddie Offord, who also produced Emerson, Lake & Palmer. So I'm just wondering if any influence there. I don't know.
I tell you what, there's a load of stories connected around this album you can tell. And what I really loved as well is they had to finish it in 2 weeks because they had to raise some money to pay for all Rick Wakeman's keyboards.
Because
the other guy only had three and he came in and had upwards of a dozen. He had Hammond, he had keys, synths everywhere. So basically they had to rush the album out so that they could raise some money to pay for all Rick Wakeman's gear.
That sounds great. Well, every time I've seen him, though, because in the early days of the Moog, the Mini Moog synthesizer, he used to have three because they used to go out hideously out of tune as they warmed up.
Oh, right.
So you were constantly having to tune them up. So as it got hotter, they'd go sharp and you'd have to keep tuning up. So that's what he used to do all the time. But absolutely amazing, the Mellotron. Anyway, yes, great record.
Wishbone Ash and Vast Is from their second studio album, Pilgrimage, which was released in September 1971 on the Decca and MCA label.
Produced by my mate, Derek Lawrence, who produced my little brother's album in 1991, was it? 99, something like that. Yeah. So, what a great track. And not a lot of people play that. It's very alternative. It's almost sort of jazzy and that scatty thing. Yeah. But I just wanted to sort of think about, because this is 1971, and I think they were taking some progressive influences, you know, from the progressive rock bands that were kicking around. You're wearing your new glasses.
I am.
Fantastic, isn't it? I just turned around. You got new glasses. You got a new glasses.
Eyes on St. Albans.
Yeah, Jez down there. He's done some great job. Now, I've got my new ones as well, but look fantastic. Just look at you. There. Wow. It's a different thing. It's a you know, Pilgrimage was a great record, and these were the guys that got me playing guitar. And we know Andy Powell, of course, you know, pretty well. He's a lovely man, you know.
Yeah.
And on that, you know, Steve Upton really features as well, who's the drummer. And I thought he was a lovely drummer, because this original incantation of Wishbone Ash, to me, were by far the best, you know. I'm sure Andy will disagree with me, but, you know, with Martin and Ted Turner not related, Steve Upton and Andy Powell on guitars, the guitar tones are just remarkable. And you know, but the thing that always gets me, and the sadness that I have, is that Martin Turner, who was the lead singer and the bass player with his Thunderbird bass, really had a sound, and it gave them the Wishbone Ash sound. It wasn't just the twin guitars.
Yeah.
And when you listen to this, and Chris Squire, of course, on the Yes record previous, you know, he was a massively influential bass player, very distorted sound, you know, quite a distorted bass sound.
Yeah, you can hear
sound.
That. Yeah.
And same with, you know, with Martin Turner. It's quite a rough sound, very powerful, you know.
Juggernaut.
And he's doing the riff in this, and he's really pinning the whole thing down, and it's a great movement to the track with Steve Upton, and then you got the guitars on top and that sort of scat vocal. Really interesting sound. And this was I'm sorry, I'm going on a bit, I've kind of quite a bit
later. No.
But it was actually recorded at D-Lane Lee Studios, and looking back on it now, Derek Lawrence, of course, produced the first couple of Deep Purple albums, and Deep Purple used to record there.
Right.
At D-Lane Studios, yeah. So, and a lot of, and also Hey Joe was recorded there by Hendrix. So it's got quite a lot of history, you know, this studio. But anyway, that's it. What do you think?
Well, it was written by a guy called Brother Jack McDuff, who was an American jazz organist and band leader. And this guy gave George Benson his first break, apparently. So it was quite interesting that they've done a song by somebody else, you know. And it was released, what was quite interesting is that it was released the same year that Focus did Hocus Pocus. But they're not, and there's nothing similar to them, really. I mean, because I read one report and it was just saying, oh, you know, did it come before or after? And it's like, well, they're just two very distinct pieces to me. They don't feel at all like they overlap. And, yeah.
I think it does. Well, when you listen to Focus, though, and yes, and all that progressive rock thing, that I think they were experimenting there, you know, because they were all getting influences, you know, from each other, and it really, to me, it shows in this particular track. But I mean, the rest of the album is completely different, really. But I thought it's quite different.
Yeah, I think that's something that's not really like, you know, what I love. But it was interesting to hear as part of a soundscape for an album concept, you know, because you've got to take this track, unlike nowadays where it's a single at a time again. But for me, it's part of a bigger perception of a bigger concept. So that's what I like about the liberty of what an album gives you, is it gives you a chance to go off the beaten track and
Correct. Do and to
change things and go places that you haven't been before. And, you know, I still love the album for that, and I still think that, you know, we should still embrace the album. So there.
I totally agree with you. And you're absolutely right thinking about it, yeah. And it's lost now, isn't it? That,
yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. Because people are playing safe now. It's like, well, we've got to keep here because it's, you know, only as good as your last broadcast kind of thing. It's like one single, one single, one single. And it's like, well, the album was such a beautiful place to for an artist, and it still is for us, you know, because it means that we can go to certain places and then we'll go, well, let's go over here. We've not been there before. and not feel that we're going to lose everything or lose our audience, you know?
I totally agree. It's a great thing, that. And I think, you know, from the Starlight Campbell Band and Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell, you're always going to get albums. You know, we'll do singles, but always albums, yeah?
Yeah.
I saw it written and I saw it say, I think a moon is on its way. None of you stand so tall. I think a moon and I get you all on the moon.
Third and final studio album released on Island Records in the UK on the 25th of February 1972.
That's 1972.
Yep.
Do you know what's really quite interesting? So it was just Nick Drake and John Wood, the producer, in the studio, and they recorded it over two sessions at night, and they went to Sound Techniques in London.
Which he was actually a partner of. He actually designed that studio.
John Wood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you know the Chairworks, when we did the knife, you know, worked quite a lot at the Chairworks in Castleford. He designed the live room in there. And you've worked a lot with Andy Seward, the bass player and producer who produced the knife. And I always get
confused because John Wood is my mate. He built my Aerial Cult 1966 as well. And so I'm thinking like John Wood from Mosley, you know, he's like, no, not that one, the other one.
Well, yeah.
Do you know, can I just say about Nick Drake, though? He scares me a bit because there's so much darkness surrounding him that I'm a bit worried to listen to his music in case I get depressed. Seriously. And I didn't realise until listening to that, really just with my eyes closed and imagining him there in the studio just for those sessions, because I know that he was, you know, going through... I started to read about him and realised that, you know, he's really finding life quite tough, you know. But it's quite beautiful, and there is no harm. That's what I realised, is that there is no harm in his music. He's actually quite beautiful. And I think I feel quite relieved now that I think I could probably embrace his music a little bit more. It's odd, isn't it? Because he's this figure, this dark, mysterious figure that died aged 26, and you just kind of go, well, who is he? Who was he?
Well, I think from a production perspective, it's a beautiful sounding vocal, beautiful sounding, you know, because people think, oh, well, it's easy to do a guitar vocalist. No, it's not, because the intimacy of that performance is great, and that the sound. And John Wood, I mean, he's pretty legendary in terms of his production, his engineering skills, and there it really shows, you know.
And what I love is that he slips and slides from the singing voice into a speaking voice. They're like he's singing and speaking all at the same time. He just goes sing, speak.
Beautiful, really, absolutely, fantastic. And was that in an advert? I mean,
yeah. Well, this is, you know, it's weird. I mean, we all know this anyway. And it was in used for a VW commercial in 1999, and it led to a boom in his US album sales. And that's what happens, of course. People hear the song and it puts it into a different context. He does kind of fascinate me, really. And the whole of life and the way that people write music and what they experience. Because he was saying, he used to just turn up at his mate's house and sit there for a few days, drink beer, fall asleep, and then disappear again for a few months. Mm. I mean, and he was just not. And I think he was frustrated that he wasn't getting more successful. I mean, these are just, obviously, I've just been reading what other people have said. But to actually still manage to have recorded some beautiful music and to have that legacy, to give that gift to us and leave that for us to be able to experience in that way, that's just priceless.
But he was one of the greatest, you know, folk singer-songwriters, you know, certainly of the 70s. And, yeah. You know, sadly missed. And, you know, now he's posthumously massively successful.
I know. Well, get in there, Nick Drake. Little Feet, and Dixie Chicken from their third studio album, Dixie Chicken, released on the 25th of January 1973 on the Warner Brothers label.
Lowell George, regarded as one of the greatest white slide guitar players.
Really?
Of all time, yeah. Used a technique of two 1176 compressors in series in the studio. So incredibly compressed sound. So there we are. Bit of technical mumbo jumbo there.
Well, it's weird, you know, because you go, who are Little Feet? Well, they're an American rock band formed by the singer-songwriter, lead vocalist, as you said, guitarist Lowell George, and keyboardist Bill Payne in LA in 1969. And though they had the trappings of a southern fried blues band, Little Feet were hardly conventional.
No. they had that sort of groove about them. It was different. It was a completely different groove to anything else that was out there at the time, you know? If you listen to it, it's sort of very, it's like swampy, and it almost sounds southern rather than California. It sounds like, you know, it's more New Orleans than, you know, LA.
It sounds fun, and then I found out that they were both in Frank Zappa's band, The Mothers of Invention.
Well, yeah.
So
that'll do something to you, won't it? Well,
gonna tell that Mary about Uncle John. He claims he has a misery, but he's having a lot of fun. Oh, baby. Yes, baby. Woo, baby. Having me some fun tonight. Yeah. Well, long tall Sally, she's a bit of a speech you got.
Richard, Long Tall Sally, from his debut album, Here's Little Richard, released in March 1957 on Speciality Records label.
Yeah, it was released as a single a year before, you know, and it was number one for 6 weeks in the Billboard Rhythm and Blues charts, and it spent a total of 19 weeks in the charts, and then it was part of the album a year later.
Lemmy's favourite act. He said he started.
Of course,
that's
I remember
right.
Yeah. that with when he was talking to Billy Bob Thornton.
That's right, and a lot of people as well. Paul McCartney, you know, they say he really started it all, you know. And you look at his stage act and all that, and then you look at, you know, Elvis. Interesting.
What I've just been reading now, actually, as well, is that when he was first playing, it was people were segregated. White people were downstairs and the black people were up in the balconies.
Yep.
And people were starting to dance in the aisles, and they could see the writing on the wall saying, this is going to bring all the races together. And everyone got really worried. Good on him.
Excellent.
Kick
Good
ass.
Lad.
Well, do you know what? This really, I mean, you can't imagine what it would have been like for him. And no matter how many documentaries you've seen, unless you've walked in that person's shoes, you just don't know what it's like on a daily basis to have that.
Pressure.
An oppression is part of your history and your day to day, and fighting through that, I have no idea. What was interesting as well, though, is that I didn't know that Pat Boone kept covering all of Little Richard's songs.
Neither did I.
This is just really weird, right? So Tutti Frutti have been a big hit, yeah.
Pat Boone?
Pat, this. Let me talk to you about Pat Boone. So Tutti Frutti got to number two in the R&B charts, yeah? A classic, absolute life-changing, a monumental song that changed everything. Pat Boone did a cover, got to number 12. And the story goes that Bumps Blackwell, who's producing it, and Little Richard, wanted to write a song so fast that Pat Boone couldn't sing it. Seriously. And so what happened, this is the story, that Bumps Blackwell was introduced to a little girl by Honey Chal, who was a popular disc jockey at the time. And the girl had written some lyrics for Little Richard to record because she wanted to pay for some treatment for her Aunt Mary, who wasn't very well.
Oh.
And the song on the paper, the lines wrote, she wrote, "Saw Uncle John with Long Tall Sally, they saw Aunt Mary coming, so they ducked back in the alley." And they didn't want to let down the little girl or upset the DJ. So they worked and worked on the lyrics until he got it really, 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 really quick. And then they recorded it.
So, that is fantastic. What a story.
Know, great. But do you know what? Pat Boone went for it. He still did a cover. See, he copied him again. Anyway, I think he didn't. I think he got to number 8 with that one.
Well, I'm going to have to listen to that, that version now anyway.
But a bit weird, isn't it?
Yep.
Anyway, but there's always somebody out there. But, you know, it's the end of the show. I thought I'd get in there first. I could tell you're looking at me.
I know. And, of course, you can pick us up on Mixcloud, Twitter, everywhere, iTunes. We're all iHeartRadio, we're everywhere, you know?
Yeah, and please tell your friends, you know, because it's lovely to hang out with you. And we've really enjoyed doing the show. And 2019 is going to be such an adventurous year. And we'll be telling you more about what we're up to musically as well over the next year. We're definitely, things are changing, aren't they? So we're very excited about that. And that's what it is. Life is changing.
We've both got new glasses.
I know. Thanks to Jez Levy. We met Jez Levy again just before Christmas with our, and we played a gig at Ice in St. Albans. And I've got to say, this guy is kick-ass. If you want somebody to choose some frames for you, you can't buy them online. You've got to walk in the shop, and he took one look at me and went, right, okay, because he styled me on my last pair, which I never would have worn, and they've become part of my identity now. And he just went plonk and went, oh, wow. He's just got this talent.
He certainly has.
He is the king of eyewear. And anyway, actually, what's quite fitting as well, we're going to play you out of the show this week with a most gorgeous, beautiful soul of a person who happens to be Laurie Anderson.
Mm.
Absolutely love this woman. She's such an inspiration. She loses me sometimes, but I don't care. There are some times when she is just the most beautiful person you could ever want to hang out with. And I've not even met her, but you just know.
And that love affair, that was so beautiful. It was so sad when Lou Reed died, wasn't it?
I know. But you know what she had? They had the love. They had their moment. You know, a lot of people don't meet somebody that they love that way. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, Superman. Oh, John. Hello? Is anybody
home? Well, you don't know me, but I know you. And I got a message to give to you. Here come the plane. So you better get ready, ready to go. You can come as you are, but pay as you go. Pay as you go. Okay, who is this really? And the voice said, this is the hand that takes. This is the hand. Your electronic arms in your arms.